Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to the Book Riot Podcast. It's a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. This is episode... We don't know episode numbers anymore. We're recording on Thursday, April 22nd, 2021. Quite a week in books. The rolling reckoning continues apace in ways that I think are mostly in the direction that I would prefer them to go. But boy, there's some ugly stuff to get through and bumpy roads ahead here. I'm Jeff O'Neill. She's Rebecca Shinsky, coming to you from BookRiot.com. We're going to do some follow-up, and we'll get into the news stories of the day. First thing on the top of the show, we don't do this very often, but there's a giveaway going on right now. I'm going to put the link in the show notes, the BookRiot hosting. It's a current affairs book bundle with a gift card that goes along with it. But the thing that's especially interesting here is one of the books in there is a little book by a guy you may have heard of called, his name is Daniel Kahneman. Right. And it's one of the books is a copy of his new book. He has co-collaborators because he's like a real academic and that's what they do. It's called Noise, and thought you'd like to know about it. There's a link in the show notes under, you go to show notes discussed in this episode. I'll put the link in there. It'll read something like giveaway for prize pack, including Daniel Kahneman's Noise. Go enter that if you'd like to check that out. Kind of a cool one.
Can
for
staff
us.
Win the Daniel?
No,
Kahneman
I think that's
book
because... in the terms of conditions, Rebecca, that we cannot award ourselves. Oh, look, it's me. I've won the award.
Gosh, how did that happen?
Yeah. So go check that out. That comes out, I think, in June.
May 18th.
May
18th. I just Googled it.
May 18th. We're saying we are entering into, we can feel like the sun warming up for the big season, the book season. Mm-hmm. We got Lahiri's book. The Bourdain book came out this week. Lahiri's book, I think, comes out next week. The new Andy Weir. We've got Kahneman. We've got all sorts of stuff coming out over the next few weeks, which means we're almost ready for our summer preview as our bonus episodes get kicked off with our moms, dads, and grads recommendation show. We still have time to get requests in. I think if you email us soon, we're going to have a great shot to get your recommendation request in. We got some more this week. Some interesting stuff there. And I think it's going to be a fun show. But then we're going to do summer preview after that. We're going to be doing a reading movies episode. Can we say what we're going to do? We've decided, right?
I think we have to. I'm very excited.
What are we doing? You've been itchy. I was surprised. You're more itchy for this than I am, which is great. But you've been really focused, especially this summer. Tell the people why.
Well, we share a love for Field of Dreams, based on the book Shoeless Joe. And I think we kicked around doing it last year, or maybe like as a possibility a couple years ago. But then last summer's baseball season was so abbreviated because of COVID and everything. When we were planning the season, it was like, who knows what we're going to feel like doing. So we saved it, and I have been anxiously waiting. I've never read Shoeless Joe, so that'll be fun. I got to visit my parents last week for the first time since the end of 2019.
So you're in the Midwest, so it feels like...
I was in the Midwest, and I got to see my brother-in-law, who is a sports radio host, and I told him we were doing this, and he begged to come on. He was like, I'll even read a book.
Listen, I don't know this person, but you can't say that you're making a huge concession for a reading movie show by saying you're reading. I'll even stoop to the level of learning.
He's like, oh, let me come on and talk about Field of Dreams. And I was like, you know what? This is a Shinsky O'Neill joint. I'm sorry.
Get your own pod. Hashtag get your own podcast.
I'll tell him. I'll even come on there and talk about baseball.
A sec. Came out in 1989. I was 11 years old. I collected baseball cards, played baseball in the Corn Belt. I think the core audience for Field of Dreams were people Kevin Costner's age in the movie, like my dad, who was 37 at the time. But it was a four quadrant movie, and kids and grandparents and men and women and all the things that were a hit. Don't see movies like that. We'll talk about it on the show. You don't see movies like Field of Dreams anymore. One of my favorite movies. It's warm enough. We had a warm enough day here that I could have watched it with like the windows open and the crickets chirping and doing all that kind of stuff. It doesn't get humid enough here to really have that full like Midwestern in the middle of a cornfield experience. But, you know, maybe I could boil some water and heat up the kitchen or something like that. Get a nice mug on.
I have a little summer ritual with it where I usually wait until like late June, and it's that. It'll be like a Saturday afternoon. Mm-hmm. The light is right. The windows are open. Yeah, crickets are doing their thing. I wait until like the sun starts.
You really do need to watch it at golden hour. I have watched before the director's commentary and how like so much of that movie is shot at golden hour in the morning and in the evening, but they have like 30 minutes of light twice a day to do it. So it's like, Kevin, stand right there. Don't screw up your lines. We got 20 minutes to get the light exactly right. So you really need to watch it. Well, it gets late. I mean, here I feel like 9 o'clock at night to get the right light.
I think if you started at 8, you're in a good position.
Right. Because then you need to end it when it's dark, because then you need the headlights coming down the thing at the end. Spoiler alert.
And there's headlights. It's easier for the gentle crying in the dark.
Moonlight Graham. So watch out for that.
Looking forward to that.
So if you want to watch or read that, or both, do that. I have read the book, but it's been a million years. Did I ever tell you I once collected baseball books? I know it's going to be a surprise to you that I collected books, but I collected and read books about baseball as a young, probably right around this age. I started reading The Glory of Their Times about the early days of baseball and a lot of the great Lawrence S. Ritter's great book about the early days of baseball. Anyway, looking forward to that. It's one of those I love to do, but then once we've done it, we've done it. That's the problem with this. So it's like,
well, I think this is what, like the third year that we will have done some of these reading movies or Book Nerd Movie Club episodes, and we didn't let ourselves do it the first year, even though this has been high on the list.
We got to dole them out slowly.
Mutual faves, Someday we'll do a River Runs Through.
I mean, that's the one. Hey, listen, okay.
Like some early September.
Yeah. It's a fall movie up there. Okay. Listener feedback. We got a bunch of, like I said, moms and graduations stuff. I don't know how I missed this, because it's a podcast I do listen to from time to time. It's The Watch. That's a Ringer joint. Chris Ryan and Andy Greenwald do host it. It's about TV primarily, but they did a Lonesome Dove read along in the spring.
I'm off the hook.
If you want the read along, I'm going to go listen to it. I guess they did it over the course. They did it as like the second segment of their show, apparently, over a number of weeks. And I haven't gone and actually looked. And then they did a roundup episode where they put all the segments in one episode. So it was all right there for people. I don't know why. I don't know. Usually I only listen. I've listened to that show over the course of time. But I usually dip in when they're talking about a show. They're on a show that I'm interested in. So they'll be on, like right now, they're doing Falcon and Winter Soldier each episode as part of their segment. So I've been on for that. I was on for WandaVision before when that was out, because I, looking for something to process and as part of my pop culture. Yeah. But if they're not talking about something I know anything about, then I'm out. So I think it was one of those interregnums. They were talking about Lonesome Dove, but it's there. I'll put a link to The Watch in the show notes. So I had multiple people say, just so you know, if people want that, it's already out there. And they did more of a read-along. I think I'm going to listen to it just to see the format. They're really smart folks. And I've listened to them a long time. I like listening to them.
I really like that idea of embedding it into a bigger show like that.
Yeah. So this is now a podcast about doing a Lonesome Dove read-along podcast. I didn't get any consensus about a form. Some people are saying, no, we want a read-along where you do four episodes and it's 150 pages. Some people are like, no, please don't do that. Just do one big one. Some are like, they like Rebecca's idea about like the sort of, I don't know, contextual anthology, course pack kind of idea. People, there's no consensus. So you were not helpful at all there, but we did learn that there is no consensus. So whatever way we decide not to do, because we're not doing this, is going to be right. Or at least won't be exactly totally wrong.
You know what the irony here is, that the likelihood of me reading Lonesome Dove has gone up now that I am not obligated to make a book club.
So probably what's going to happen is you will sort of read it. You really need to read it in the summer. We can't do this now anyway. We got a lot of time to talk about how we're not going to do this. We still got a lot of time to talk about how this is never going to happen into July and August. But what you'll do probably is you'll text me and say, okay, I'm starting it. And then it'll be like, God, Lonesome Dove was great, right? And then I'm going to hit record. I'm going to call you and hit record, and we're going to go.
Fair. That's
I'm just going to have my takes in a holster, ready to shoot from the hip.
Takes in a holster. That's great.
ready to fire.
I look forward to it.
Double-barreled close reading. Also, I'm just throwing show titles at you left and right.
It's a beautiful dream.
It's really great stuff. But thank you for your unhelpful feedback about Lonesome Dove, everyone.
You can send more to podcast@bookriot.com.
Yeah, you can. Thanks. I will ignore all of it. Happily read and ignore all of your advice for what we should do for the Lonesome Dove. Relong. Okay, let's do a sponsor break and come back and do other follow-up that's not from listeners that we're going to ignore.
Today's episode is brought to you by Flatiron Books, publisher of The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo. This is one I'm actually super excited about. I liked Leigh Bardugo's other adult fantasy books, and so I'm really looking forward to this one. It's set in the Spanish Golden Age during a time of high-stakes political intrigue and glittering wealth. It follows Luzia, a servant in the household of an impoverished Spanish nobleman who reveals a talent for little miracles. Her social climbing mistress demands Luzia use her gifts to win over Madrid's most powerful players, but what begins as simple amusement takes a dangerous turn. Luzia will need to use every bit of her wit and will to survive, even the help of Guillén Santángel, an immortal familiar whose own secrets could prove deadly for them both. So The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo is on sale now. And like I said, it's a must-read of the season. It's perfect for anyone who loves history, a little bit of magic, a lot of danger. You can get your copy now at LeighBardugoTheFamiliar.com. And thanks again to Flatiron Books, publisher of The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by National Geographic Books. So take a second, think to yourself, what is one of the weirdest but kind of interesting, intriguing, intelligent animals that you know of? If you, like me, think of an octopus, then Secrets of the Octopus by Cy Montgomery is the book for you. It is a beautifully illustrated book that explores the underwater world of the octopus, a creature that resembles an alien life form, but whose behavior has earned it a reputation as one of the most intelligent animals on the planet. This journey into the world of the octopus reveals how large their brains are. They occupy their whole body, not just their heads. They can adjust their genetic makeup to respond to the demands of the environment. So with this book, you can see how the octopus can change shape and color to camouflage themselves more effectively than any other species. They are cool AF. So learn about all of this and more in Secrets of the Octopus. And thanks again to National Geographic Books for sponsoring this episode.
Okay, this happened the day we recorded last week?
Yes. Yeah, the evening after the show was in.
So SNS, hot upon the heels of us recording, said they're going to refuse to distribute the book by the officer involved in Breonna Taylor's death, which was a title that was Post Hill Press had announced. SNS claims they didn't know anything about it. I've seen some chatter. I'm not going to link into anything directly about that. Seems very unlikely for people who work in publishing that Post Hill Press would just drop this bomb of a news thing. It doesn't usually happen like that. Not to say it's impossible, but it would be unusual. We might be in the realm of the possible but not plausible in this kind of a situation. But that news came the evening we recorded the show. We thought about going back and putting a header or anything on it, but I think people understand we're live to tape here. You know, we tell you when we record so you know, happening in real time. I guess, were you surprised to see, A, the speed, B, at all, that this happened in this way?
I was not really surprised to see it happen. Yeah. The online backlash against it was swift and ferocious, as it should have been. Mm-hmm. And I thought, okay, I expect Simon & Schuster to do something about this, especially if they didn't know that this was coming. And I think I've seen the same chatter, or at least similar chatter that you've seen, of folks saying it would be really unusual for a distribution client not to tell Simon & Schuster about this big deal that they were going to make. And then again, maybe if you're trying to make a splash and do a Streisand effect, get a lot of attention for this gross book deal that you're making, this is a way to have achieved that in some fashion, especially given like, I don't know, my tinfoil hat is like halfway on at this point. Like, given the conversations on the right about cancel culture, if you're a small, super conservative press and you can set up a situation where it looks like big publishing tried to cancel you, you can maybe get some
make some stinky hay out of it. Yeah, great.
Yeah, the stinkiest hay. So I'm actually kind of surprised that Simon & Schuster responded as quickly as they did, just because of how big of an organization that is. And I assume that this required someone to review a contract somewhere and determine that it was a thing that could be done. And just knowing how expensive and sometimes slow moving like corporate attorney situations can be, I thought that we would maybe get something like, the story broke on a Thursday, and I thought we would maybe get something by like Monday. But I was really pleased to see that they responded so quickly. And I had a moment of like, oh, and now we know you can respond that quickly. So
the letter was really interesting, about it to the public, really, about how it's an unusual circumstance. They don't want to get in the habit of doing this, which I thought was maybe the most forward looking kind of signal about what they can and can't do, or what they can and can't commit to. And I think it's one of those situations where the generous reading, I mean, it's hard. I think it's probably both hard and usually a mistake too often to give companies the generous reading. But if you did that, this is a new world. And these existing structures that have been built up over time, which may or may not directly enforce systemic bias and racism and misogyny and other kinds of bias, can be used to do so, even if they're not sort of built with that in mind. And hiding behind our distribution agreement or whatever that is going to have to cause people to think about one of, it's almost, it reminds me of the NDA as a structure, right? There is a world in which the NDA is useful, but does the cost outweigh the benefits of what the NDA, the kind of bad behavior the NDA can cover up? Or and knowing you can get someone to sign an NDA kind of authorizes behavior, right? Because you know a lot of it can be cleaned up down the road. That if we're going to agree that a publisher doesn't have plausible deniability for quote-unquote ownership of a title anymore. You can't just say anymore, well, we just distribute that. If that's no longer, your hands are not clean after that attempted washing, that's a new thing in the world of books and reading.
Yeah, and I think you're right that nugget about we don't think this is a thing we're going to do very often is telling, and that is a piece that it looks like folks are continuing to push on. There's a campaign circulating largely on Instagram this week that includes several demands, one of which is that publishers, including Simon & Schuster, examine all of their distribution clients, like currently re-examine all of their existing distribution clients, and then have ongoing efforts to evaluate them and root out anything that supports any of these, you know, systems of oppression. And I support the notion and also have no idea how a huge publisher goes about actually executing that on any time frame that is satisfying. I think it's many steps over a long road, and this is a first step. It's an important first step, a publisher actually refusing. This is the first time I've heard about something like this on this scale, of a big publisher refusing to distribute a title from one of its distribution clients. And if anybody listening knows of other examples, I would really be interested in those. So you can shoot those to us in email. That seems meaningful. And also, like, the folks inside Simon & Schuster running the show there are anticipating that there may be more of these. We don't know what other kinds of book deals they might be working on. I would love to be a fly on the wall, like, at the other big publishing houses. Are the folks at PRH also concerned about...
Well, they better be, because they're buying Simon & Schuster. Yeah. This is their problem.
Well, yeah, that's right. That's true. But what kind of distribution clients do they have? PRH has a ton of distribution clients. What kind of books do they publish? What surprise might get dropped on them? So I was, you know, happy to see the response that I think is the correct response of, we don't want to be involved in putting this book into the world. You know, the next step that folks are asking for is Simon & Schuster to cancel its entire relationship with Post Hill Press. And it doesn't seem like that's going to happen. We can get into the details of that in a little bit. But I think that this is a common feeling in activism work, is this is a little bit of progress And by nature of being a little bit, it doesn't feel fully satisfying. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not the full change that we all wish to see in this industry or in the world. And I also don't want to let it go that it was progress still.
Right.
This is meaningful that a large publisher has made this decision. And now we all know that they can make a change to their contract like that. And they can do it within 24 hours of the question coming out or the problem being raised. And that's a thing that Simon & Schuster's employees are not going to forget. It's a thing their critics are not going to forget. That's, and I don't know, I hope, you know, that they considered that this is a thing that they have now revealed to the world, that this is available as an option. These things can be changed, and it'll really be interesting to see where it goes from here.
Yeah. And, you know, that accountability is an interesting phrase that's been talked about, especially in the light of, you know, justice versus accountability in the George Floyd case that came down this week too. I think it's hard to know, but does this particular case, how much was it influenced by its relationship to the end of the George Floyd case, I think is interesting. Also in the context of Simon & Schuster, we'll get to this topic here in a little bit too, Simon & Schuster signing a deal with Mike Pence, right? Mm-hmm. Suddenly you've got a, you know, you've got multiple things here. I think on its own, it's this was worthy of backlash, criticism, critique, action on the part of Simon & Schuster's. But it felt like this boiling water was poured into an already scalding vessel over the last 10 days or so. And that matters. That's how things get done, is that the environment is right and ready. Mm-hmm. And this happened with such speed, it feels like Simon & Schuster not just felt pressured into doing it, but they kind of wanted to do it. That's the other thing I read into the speed.
I think so.
A little, and I don't know if that's fair, but to turn around that quick, you can't turn around that quick and get through the legal and the but what about ism stuff that would be done internally if people didn't actually want to do it. I don't know if that's fair to you, or does that resonate at all with you?
I think that's fair, and I think it goes back to, we talked about this last week a little bit, the rising social and public accountability for platforms in general of what they allow and enable to be put out into the world. And in the same way that we saw like Facebook and Twitter start to block or remove certain types of content and implicitly acknowledge that they have some accountability and some responsibility for the information that they enable out into the world. Mm-hmm. I think Simon & Schuster is saying that. I think that's built in here, even though they haven't said it in that way, of we don't want to be part of putting this book out into the world. We don't want to be part of this guy getting a platform. We're, you know, this is what part of that accountability looks like. And that distinction between justice and accountability is really useful here, because I think what we're pushing for is a world that within publishing looks just and in which people are not rewarded with giant book deals for doing things like killing a Black woman who's just asleep in her own home, and publishers don't profit off of helping to distribute books like that. And we don't live in that world yet, but this is a step in that direction.
Yeah, or you know, at the very least, it's no longer tenable for a big five publisher to hide, be protected by whatever passive voice you want to use, a screen of we're just a distributor. Because I think people realize that the system is the problem, and the distribution feels like a new sort of like a neutral conduit of like moving X unit of widget from A to B, but we know it's not.
But it's not.
Because you control those pipelines, and what goes in them matters. Ergo, you know, it's your responsibility to keep the pipes clean, at least in far as you're willing to do it and want to do it and can afford to do it. How lucrative these distribution deals, that's one thing I haven't seen. Like, what if Post Hill Press decided, you know, we're walking tomorrow? Does it make a difference? Does it, like, how important are these distribution deals to the big five publishers or other major publishers that do have distribution deals? If they just walked away from them all and said, you know what, we're in the worst of both worlds here, because we don't get most of the money from publishing the books, but we take all the heat, right?
Right.
So why do this? That would be the question I'd be asking today if I was in charge of a publisher that had distribution deals with, that doesn't have editorial or like publicity or other, any kind of control or say in what books are going to flow through the pipes. Why am I just letting people do whatever? Because I'm not making as much as the publisher, and I'm getting more, I'm getting as much, if not more heat from the public because I'm a bigger name and I got a bigger placard and they've heard of Simon & Schuster, not Post Hill Press before.
Right. If we have a birdie, I would be super interested in like what percentage of Simon & Schuster's revenue or any of the big publishers' revenue is from these distribution deals.
Yeah. Anyway, so let's take another break because we've got more more Simon & Schuster stuff to do as relates to especially to this, but also to the Pence book deals.
Today's episode is brought to you by Harper Horizon, publisher of Walk, Ride, Paddle. Walk, Ride, Paddle is a captivating memoir of Senator Tim Kaine's physical journey through the Virginia wilderness, but it is also a unique and ultimately optimistic perspective on these pivotal moments in history, offering inspiration, wisdom, and hope. With immediacy and honesty, Kaine pulls back the curtain to reveal his inner thoughts during such monumental times. And Kaine's storytelling gift and wise observations offer a fascinating glimpse into the mind of a seasoned politician and outdoor enthusiast. Walk, Ride, Paddle is available everywhere audiobooks are sold on April 9th. It is narrated and written by Tim Kaine, Virginia senator and former Democratic vice presidential candidate. It's a compelling account of one man's journey across hundreds of miles of Virginia wilderness and a moving testament to the optimistic spirit of America. So make sure to check out Walk, Ride, Paddle by Tim Kaine. And thanks again to Harper Horizon, publisher of Walk, Ride, Paddle, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Harper Perennial, an imprint of HarperCollins Publishers. The author of Love Buzz follows her acclaimed first novel with a delightful Caribbean-set romp about video game designer Sloane Cooper, who has a strategy for everything. Almost. Against her better judgment, Sloane says yes to going on a Caribbean vacation with her neighbor. She thinks she can use the time away to develop a game design that will help her get a job offer. But the question is, can Sloane figure out a way to move past heartbreak, land the job of her dreams, all while avoiding catching feelings? She's up against a lot, y'all. In a Not-So-Perfect World by Neely Tubati Alexander, there is this delightful romantic comedy. There's neighbors and lust, a fake dating scheme, and it also explores the all-too-real demands and costs of female ambition, especially for women working in traditionally male arenas. So make sure to pick up the new book. Thanks again to Harper Perennial, an imprint of HarperCollins Publishers, for sponsoring this episode.
My timeline for this is a little wonky. Tell me if I'm right. I think, so there's a petition from employees at Simon & Schuster that's centrally about the Mike Pence book deal. That came after, it did come after Simon & Schuster says we're not doing this other one, the Post-Hill Press
book. Simon & Schuster last Thursday evening said that they were not going to distribute that one Post-Hill Press book by the officer involved in the murder of Breonna Taylor. So on the heels of that decision, a letter from the workforce of Simon & Schuster came out. I think it came out on the 19th or the 20th earlier this week, protesting the entire deal with Post-Hill Press, asking that Simon & Schuster stop the distribution deal completely, and then also demanding that they cancel Mike Pence's book deal. So that, sorry, we have a piece from Kirkus by Michael Schaub that came out on April 20th, sort of highlighting the arguments made in that letter from Simon & Schuster employees there.
Yeah.
So yeah, that happened, and then...
We don't know. It's interesting. Of late, I've said multiple times, both on this show and frankly in private conversations we have had around work and in other situations, about how I sort of think that rank and file publishing employees, at least of the middle tier and up, I can't say about smaller publishers because you sort of get niche, and I don't have a good sense of that. Probably have a similar worldview to us when it comes to the world of books and reading. They've been around, if you're 20s up into your early 40s, you've been around in the world of the internet of books and reading that we've been in over the last 10 years. We've been a part of that conversation. We've been covering it. We've been responding to it in our own way. You know it's part of the thing. It's probably something you care about as well as this point. And I think Simon & Schuster pulling the Post-Hill Press book and this employee petition are exhibits what N through M of that theory, right? Like, this is the kind of thing you would see if that hypothesis is true. Because I don't know what percentage of Simon & Schuster employees this represents, how many are going to sign them. Like, there's a bunch of, like, logistical things that are strange about this, and I'm not interested in that because I don't have skin in the game of actually being a Simon & Schuster employee. But I think The other thing that's really changed, and we've seen it multiple times, we saw it with the Woody Allen biography, we've seen some other stuff. I think this Blake Bailey thing, maybe it was on its face, we're going to talk about in a minute, is a kind of a similar situation as well, where constituent one for a company anymore, and this is outside, this is in excess of the of publishing. I think this is so true in so many companies now. I think it's true in our company. That constituent one is your employees.
I agree.
And that is, if that's the case, then this is the kind of thing you would see happening out of it, right? And I think that's interesting. I think that's important. I think there is a moral de facto unionization kind of happening in publishing at this point, which is fascinating to me to see.
Yeah, I think that's a moral unionization is a great way to put it, because that does seem to be what we're seeing, or the pattern at least that's developing after the walkout over the Woody Allen title, which was also at Simon & Schuster. And it's interesting that they didn't pick up that technique again. Like on the day that Simon & Schuster employees planned to walk out, I got out of office responses from folks at Simon & Schuster that I have contact with that were like, you know, I'm out of office this afternoon. I'm walking out in protest of the Woody Allen memoir. So it's an open letter. It's signed by the workforce of Simon & Schuster, but there aren't individual names attached. Which
there could be three signatures or 5,000. Like, I really don't know at this point. Yeah, it's hard to know how much juice it's got.
And if and if there were 5,000, you would want that because it would be really powerful. But the fact that they didn't reveal it doesn't mean there's not 5,000 and only three. You like, there are just so many questions about it. But I do think that we're seeing that, that publishers have responded, or Simon & Schuster has had to respond from pressure from its own employees about the work they're being asked to do functionally. And, you know, not everybody at Simon & Schuster has to work on a Mike Pence book, but they're all getting paid with funds, you know, potentially impacted by those kinds of book deals. It's all going into the company's coffers, and it matters that your employees trust you and feel good about company values. And I think that's fundamentally what this is, that publishing has hid for a very long time behind these statements about, you know, we value free exchange of ideas, and that's the reason that we're publishing this book full of harmful ideas about people or a group of people or how human beings should be treated or should interact with each other. But we're just a platform. And if you are acknowledging that you're not just a platform, then you're allowing this crumbling to happen, and it should be happening, I think. But the employees are very, I think, rightfully seeing, all right, well, if we're not just a platform and we don't want responsibility for distributing this other book, what else can we ask our company not to be responsible for being a party to? And the Mike Pence book deal is a timely and ripe example.
Yeah. The letter, so I think if you're interested, there'll be a link in the show notes of both of them. The petition from Simon & Schuster employee, we don't know. There could, this could be one person. Right. I mean, again, this is one of the difficult parts of sort of employee mobilization, because you're at risk of getting fired and there's other legal things that go on. One of the uses of a unionization is you get a shield from like direct retribution. The letter Jonathan Karp, who is the president and chief executive officer of Simon & Schuster, released on, looks like this was Tuesday, saying we're not going to undo the Mike Pence deal, but we did undo the Post Hill Press deal. And it's an interesting trying to middle those, right? That, you know, it's an interesting management situation. I was looking at this as a manager myself, like, boy, I think if you were reading the room about your own workforce correctly, you would not be reacting to the Mike Pence acquisition. It sounds like it sounds like there was a town hall after the deal was announced, and then the petition, and then there's the response. One of my critiques here is the Mike Pence book is a weird case, and we've talked about that before. It's a difficult case in a lot of different ways, and we can talk about that if we want to. But I think you should have known it was going to be a difficult case no matter what you were going to do. I think that's the part I'm most surprised by, is they seem unprepared to handle people saying, wait, what the hell are we doing with this book?
Yeah, it's, I was telling a friend earlier that short of a world in which all the big five get together and decide mutually, we're not going to publish books by these people.
Vice presidents of the United States. It's, I mean, you have to say it. I mean, it's germane.
Even if the big five agreed to that principle, it's really difficult to imagine a world where a book by a former vice president is not newsworthy. Mm-hmm. And like there was part of my business brain was like, well, if Simon and Schuster drops him, PRH or HarperCollins are going to pick him up. Like somebody is going to make money right. on this. And I wish that that weren't true. And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe getting dropped by Simon and Schuster because of pressure from inside would signal to other big publishers, hey, this is not worth it. Mm-hmm. And I do think the Mike Pence one is a tricky situation because he's not just like a run-of-the-mill Trump administration yeah. lackey who's writing a memoir. This is not a Kellyanne Conway two memoir book deal. We are talking about the vice mm-hmm. president, and that is that's newsworthy, and I hate it, mm-hmm. but I think that's true. And I think you're right that the CEO of Simon & Schuster really misread the room by being like, you know, we canceled that one. We're not doing that one deal with Post Hill Press, but we have an obligation to our clients. We're going to keep those. So I think he's probably also seen some of the other demands that are circulating yeah. of like reevaluate all of our, you know, all of our distribution clients and all of the titles they publish. And this implicitly says no. And then there's, I think the worst part of this letter that's pretty insulting is actually, he says, a few years ago, when we were considering a book project by an esteemed political leader, she described the story of America as, quote, two steps forward, one step back. For those who think some of our titles are a step backwards, let's appreciate the many Simon and Schuster books that are taking us two steps forward. Let's also acknowledge that we don't agree on which titles are taking us forward and backward. That tension, that push and pull, is a healthy part of the dialectic provided by classically liberal publishing companies. And, you know, I agree with some of that. I think that healthy dialogue and a push and pull is part of a healthy democracy. And it's also not something that we've seen in our democracy for the last, I don't know, 6 years at least. We haven't had a lot of reasonable, actual policy-based argument coming out of the right. But that notion of two steps forward, one step back also seems to, he seems to kind of agree here. The Mike Pence book deal is one step back, but let's just ignore that because some of the work we do is two steps forward. Like some days we hug people and lift them up and other days we make them bleed.
For every two hugs, we get to slap you in the face once.
Right. So let's just forget about the slapping.
Right.
Because sometimes
or that's just the cost
people.
Of the hugs.
Yeah. And I think I get, I mean, I see where he's trying to go here.
Right.
I would be very upset to receive a letter like this from my employer. I think that framework mm-hmm. around it is very insulting. Of you should feel fine about these things, or you should at least accept these things that you find abhorrent because we also do some good things. It's like the publishing version of Some of My Best Friends Are Black. Like, I just did this racist thing, but I also am nice sometimes. Mm-hmm. It's just very tone deaf. And I think reveals a failure of imagination that they did not consider what their employees were going to have to say about the Mike Pence book deal, or that the like reading public at large, to whatever degree readers have been paying attention to and responding to this, would care.
Yeah. Yeah, it also just doesn't feel like the truth somehow. Like, it feels like...
right.
In my experience, telling the truth for your reasoning conveyed reasonably and at the right time can go a long way. Because I've said this before on the show. If I'm Simon Schuster, I was talking to Amanda, one of our coworkers, about mm-hmm. this issue the other day, and we were talking about it from several different angles because I think we're both wrestling with this. World historical events, world historical right. person, this feels like the kind of thing that's going to, it's all the historical record. It's fair game for historical record, and, you know, it just is going to be what it is. Now, maybe someone else will publish it. Does that then authorize you to do it? I don't know. I'm not a publisher. I don't know. This is what came down to for me. Say Book Riot had its own colophon, its own imprint. I couldn't look at a Mike Pence book with that colophon on it. I couldn't look. No. There's no way I could do it. So that tells you something about me. That's where I would be. I could see no way I could do this myself. My job's not on the line for this, though. I don't know what their situation is here. I think it would have been helpful to get out ahead of this and say, it's been a very tumultuous 4 years. We're all dealing with this. There's a lot of work to be done in a lot of ways. The goal of our company is to be involved in the production and dissemination of major texts that have world, national and world import. Mm-hmm. That's what this book is. At least we think by being as part of the process, we can see it to publication a way we feel good about. And that also, I would say, it's a big deal for our company to get this book. And then you got to let the chips fall where they may. There, what else is there to say? I don't know what else you can say.
It's giving people credit to understand something like that. It would have been a great move.
Yeah. And I'm not saying it would have worked, but it's better than this.
But it's better. It's better than this. And I think this also, this letter reveals the gap between this letter and the letter from Simon & Schuster's workforce. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of light between those two things. And it seems that there is not alignment on what the values or the mission of Simon & Schuster are. And I think that's where the work really is for these publishing companies now, where the classically liberal publishing companies, the model of that, your staff, at least to some degree, are pushing for a redefinition of what does it mean to be a publishing company? What is the discourse that a publishing company wants?
We don't want to be classically liberal. We want to be newly progressive is kind of what the employees seem to be saying. Right?
Yeah. What is the discourse that we want to participate in and support and enable and be a part of? Mm-hmm. And staff are not agreeing that this is valuable. And, Book Riot, I think it's an interesting example. I agree. I would not feel good about a Mike Pence book with a Book Riot colophon on it. And also, we couldn't publish a Mike Pence book with a Book Riot colophon on it without violating the community guidelines that we've agreed on from day one that are posted on our site and that our staff and our contributors are held to, and having everyone who touches anything we make understand those and understand, you don't even have to agree with these, but the work you do has to align with them. Right. It matters and also provides a useful framework. And I think Simon & Schuster has some work to do there. And, I want to acknowledge we're a staff of 15 people. So it's a lot easier.
Yeah, I acknowledge that too. It's way easier to do.
Yeah, it's way easier for us to do that. And because our values are what they are, people self-select in as contributors as well, who largely align with those principles.
But we're also not a player for Mike Pence's book. And Simon Schuster is. And with those stakes comes that responsibility and those,
And it's, hard if there's not a written statement of what the company's values are to be a leader in that position and have anything to point to other than this is how we've always done it. And it seems that that's what he's falling back on is this is what publishing has always done. We have always published books on both sides of the aisle or all along the political spectrum. This one is certainly newsworthy. He's the former vice president of the United States. We're going to do it. And I think it's still not going to go down well for a lot of folks. They're still not going to be happy that Simon & Schuster is doing this, that they have to see this happen at their employer, but they might feel a little bit less gross about it if it were somehow grounded in what a shared understanding of the company's values are.
Yeah. You'd almost have to frame it like you're a history book. We have to include history, even if it's ugly. The profitability, the profiting part from it and the enrichment of the person is tough. In my crisis management language crafting brain, I don't have a sentence that helps me with that. What's interesting is, at least in Jonathan Karp's mind in this letter, somewhere between the officer that killed Breonna Taylor and Mike Pence is the line. Mm-hmm. That negotiation of the line is very difficult, I think. If that's where the line is somewhere between there, I don't know. It's very hard to say because Mike Pence has championed legislation and policies that it's very difficult not to, from my point of view, not to say really put people in danger, that marginalized people in danger. How do you swallow that and put the book out? I don't think I could do it. Can someone else, if someone else can do it, I think the book is going to be out there. It probably should, quote unquote, be out there. We need these documents. We need people on the record. We need this stuff to happen. Do you need to make $6 million off it? Does it need to be you? So what if he publishes on Kindle? So what? It'll still be out there. I don't know. It's one of the harder ones I've felt like, Rebecca, because if it's Mike, if it's a junior congressperson from Iowa, I'm like, get out. I don't want any, I really have no tolerance, but it's the truth of the matter is the country elected these guys. That is true. The record of them is important. But as a private corporation, do you, quote unquote, have to be in that game? I guess I'm leaning no. I really am leaning no. Someone else is going to get the money. Let someone else pass the buck. Let's shame, whatever it is. Can we give some cultural signals for those of us with power to say, no, we're not going to do this. This is not a healthy push and pull. You know who's on the other side of this rope? It's not internal at Simon & Schuster. The other end of this rope is OAN, One America News. Mm-hmm. They're the pulling. I don't need to push and pull the rope. They're the ones pulling. I got to push. That's our job, is to push here. So we have to be both sides. It's like, no, you don't. Mm-hmm. The push and pull is America, not you.
Right.
Anyway, now I'm heated up.
Rightfully so. You know, I think it's really easy to lose sight of the fact that each individual instance of a decision like this really matters when you're sitting at the top mm-hmm. of a company as big as Simon & Schuster, and you have a long history of books by people who did things that people really objected to, and you published those,
right?
And you feel fine about it, or at least like nothing bad happened to your company about it. And I think maybe that's also a misreading of this moment by leaders in these kinds of companies, is maybe you do have a history of having, I guess, functionally gotten away with it. Mm. But what we're seeing now is the people who work for you, who enable you to put these books out, are no longer going to cooperate.
Yeah.
Or they're at least going to make it really difficult for mm-hmm. you. And you need to pay attention to that. That's an important signal.
Yeah.
And I would love to see a world where the folks at the top of the Big Five all agree we are not giving platform, we're not giving airtime to people who have furthered these kinds of policies. We don't want to pay them mm-hmm. and reward them for that kind of work or for that kind of speech. That's not censorship. We just don't want to be part of it.
We don't want to be in that business. We don't want that product. We'll take a pass on that.
Right.
And you know, who's next? McMillan, if they had signed it, they would have got the same heat.
Yep.
Is it worth it? I mean, I don't know, maybe the older school publishers, or maybe some people in publishing or lodge really are, they have a sort of, maybe they have a different kind of they have a different kind of understanding than I do, that there's their political beliefs, right? And then there's what the company does. And they're related, but different, maybe. I think.
Yeah. And
we don't operate quite like that. I mean, we have, you know, more alignment with our personal political beliefs generally than maybe a lot of people are afforded, because we have a lot of say over the particular company. But I'm also sympathetic to the case of, does everyone at Simon & Schuster have to agree with everything every Simon & Schuster author says? Because that's also not the truth. But then that's where it's tricky. It feels like this is trying to say, well, two steps back, one more forward. It's like we're going to publish stuff that you don't disagree with. Get used to it. I mean, maybe there's that straight talk like that. I don't know.
Maybe. And, you know, I think also that most folks have more nuanced understanding of that. I'm sure that if you're a progressive employee at Simon & Schuster, this is not the first book that your employer has published that you've disagreed with, and that you've understood that to some degree that tension is part of the deal, that its publishers exist to make money and they provide value to their shareholders.
Yeah.
And part of doing that is profiting off of the conservative end of the political spectrum also, even though publishing tends to be dominated by the liberal end of the spectrum.
Right.
Like, folks have held that tension. That's just part of mm-hmm. being in the industry. It's notable that this is the breaking point, you know, and I am really just... talk about A/B testing the universe. Like, I'm very curious, because when Simon & Schuster dropped Woody Allen, he didn't get picked up by another big publisher.
Was it Simon & Schuster?
He got picked up. Yeah.
Okay. I'm confused.
Skyhorse
picked him up. I thought it was Hachette, but I could be confused. It doesn't matter. A Big Five, whatever. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. He couldn't get picked up by another Big Five. He got picked up by a small imprint that does that kind mm-hmm. of stuff. And I suspect that that is not what would have happened with somebody like the vice president of the United States. Like, my guess.
Someone's
is
here
that
to catch this hot potato.
Right. One of the other Big Five would have gotten it. It's a different kind of hot potato than mm-hmm. the Woody Allen hot potato of grossness. All of these are disgusting potatoes, but of different flavors. And that does require we're really talking about systems. It requires a systemic change in the industry and structural decision making by the people who have the kinds of power to make that decision, not only within their company, but to have either some kind of example that gets set and places pressure on other publishers then not to pick up the gross mm-hmm. thing.
Yeah.
Or an agreement among folks across companies that we're going to move in a new direction. Yeah. And this is that kind of push. This is, you know, the thing that the employees are pushing for. And I think the thing that part of the reading community is pushing for as well.
Yeah. It's interesting, too, to think about, again, we could also say the name of this podcast could be called That's Not Censorship, right? And we just point to everything we've seen because, you know, people are going to do that thing and like censorship. This is the marketplace of ideas at work. These kinds of mm-hmm. discussions, these kinds of difficult, hairy, ugly, I don't think it's gotten ugly. I think just very fraught, right? This is Simon & Schuster with its employees, with the marketplace, jerks like us on the internet, sort of trying to figure out what we are interested in buying, so to speak, and selling, really. Like, how are we going to be involved in this? And we've talked about this many times going back really to the beginning of the show, of a cognitive dissonance in for-profit publishers saying, performing a social good, right? That this is what we do. We make ideas. the underlying thing we've also said is that reading and books aren't neutral. There's no neutral place to go here. Like the you can't be neutral. The great, you know, thing that says you are taking a position, even if it feels like you're not taking a position, right, by trying to retreat to the high ground of books and information into the world is an aggregate good, suggests that you have no authority, no ability, no discernment, no taste to decide what you then do. Because you might as well do it all then, because it all matters. And now it's just what's going to make you the most money. That's
right.
What it is.
It also assumes that all ideas are beneficial,
right,
and support progress,
yeah,
to whatever your version of a good world looks like.
Yeah.
And that can't be true.
It can't be true.
Whatever your vision of the world is,
right,
it cannot be true that all ideas support it,
right,
and are good for furthering that goal.
Well, and if it does, it means you can't decide. You shouldn't have editors.
Right.
You shouldn't do any. You just have to
right.
put it out there, and you're deciding, I guess, what you think is going to make the most money. Which, that's mm-hmm. not what they say. That's why I sort of like putting higher on the Maslow's hierarchy of apology letters, money.
Uh-huh.
Like, maybe people will then crack on them for that too. I'm sure people crack on everyone for anything, but like, this is an important book that aligns with what we do as a business, be a significant financial situation, you know, a significant financial part of what we do next year. And then you've got to live with the people who don't agree with you. And some of them, you sign their paychecks.
Yeah.
I think that's the only way you can do it. I think clearly too, the other thing that's happened here is like, again, assuming that there is a meaningful number of Simon & Schuster employees who really hate this, which I would imagine there are, you don't have any trust with them. You haven't earned any brownie points
right.
that you can then spend saying, you know, I know what you guys think. I know I'm on the other side of this line than you, of feeling like what's damaging, what's aligned with our mission, and what aligns with our company continue to operate. You're on the other side of the line. I'm on one side of the line. And we're going to constantly have to negotiate that line together. That's all you can say. All right, let's do our last sponsor here.
Today's episode is brought to you by Amazon Publishing. Let me ask you a question. How well do you think you know people? And how well do you think they know you? 6 award-winning, best-selling authors of suspense explore the lingering threat of secrets and the inescapable fear that they can't stay buried forever. So no matter how dark the hiding place, the consequences of revealing the truth can bring out the worst in lovers, friends, family, and strangers. And check this out. You can read and listen to all 6 short stories in the Never Tell collection free with Prime. You can learn more at amazon.com/nevertell. And these best-selling authors include Liv Constantine, Laureth Ann White, Andrea Bartz, Rachel Housel Hall, Avi Pachoda, and Carolyn Kepnes. Again, you can read and listen to all 6 short stories free with Prime and also Kindle Unlimited. So make sure to check it out. And thanks again to Amazon Publishing for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Amazon Publishing. So I got a story with a little Old West debauchery, if you want to get a little messy. So there is a city steeped in the Old West mess. And in the city, a reporter is following every lead to a dangerous place, one that could bring him glory and fame or end his life. New York Times bestselling author Robert Dugoni is back with a gripping new thriller of corruption, vice, and murder set in Depression-era Seattle. It's about a reporter covering a hot murder trial who soon learns nothing is what it seems. The story can make his career if he lives to write about it. You can learn more at amazon.com/A Killing on the Hill. So yes, A Killing on the Hill by Robert Dugoni is what you need to pick up if you are into some Depression era danger in Seattle. It's a city of big dreams and dark ambitions, and this reporter gets caught up in the muck. So make sure to check it out. And thanks again to Amazon Publishing for sponsoring this episode.
Well, should we go to the way other side of the line?
Let's.
I mean, what a story to break. Oh, I'm going to something else. It's not on here.
Oh. Okay.
Blake Bailey.
Oh, yeah, I saw that this morning. Okay.
I think we have to do a little bit of a content warning here. I feel like I should that we're going to talk about Blake Bailey being dropped by Norton and his biography of Philip Roth, immediately being pulled from Shipping and Selling by Norton. And it's related to
sexual assault
and rape, and misconduct. Yeah. So I think this will be our last segment for the day. So thank you so much for listening. Sorry to have to do this at the end, but we have to cover this story. It's an important story to cover. You can find links at bookriot.com/listen. Go enter the giveaway. Give us feedback about how you would like to hear us not do Lonesome Dove sometime in the future over there. Blake Bailey, who has come to prominence as a literary biographer and has been working on a recently published Philip Roth biography for a number of years, maybe like a decade or something like that, and was positioned to write the authoritative Roth biography. I was planning on reading this someday. Maybe I was going to read that Hermione Lee's Tom Stoppard biography that's 800 pages, you know, in the someday maybe. Maybe just lay those books on my grave and I'll get to them when I'm dead. Came out this week after, it sounds like, some time of rumblings of people who've had a bad experience with Blake Bailey, of numerous bad behaviors, felonious behaviors, if the allegations are true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That range from his first statement was, I did things that were deplorable, but not illegal. That's where we started with this journey a couple days ago. And yesterday it turned into, we got people, women going on the record saying, I was raped by Blake Bailey at Dwight Garner's house. Did you see that detail?
No.
Over a long weekend, we were both saying there, like, it's really sordid in the publishing world. Dwight Garner, if you don't know, is a critic and author. And I can't remember whose names his. I'll put the links if you want to go see. I don't want to say the names if they haven't been officially confirmed or anything here on the women's side. I want to be very careful about that, but I'll put the links in there and you can go find for yourself. And Norton pulled the book. We're done with this. And apparently, this allegation, specifically the most serious one, is something that this person told Norton about before the book came out.
Oh.
It's a very distressing story. I guess one thing we've said before, all the way going back to the first time Me Too entered into the world of books and reading, that we were going to hear more of these. It's going to take a long time. And maybe we would never be done in sort of on the time frame that we're dealing with. I guess I found myself surprised again. Blake Bailey is someone I used to follow on Twitter when I did Twitter, a serious, quote unquote, independent literary historian. I don't know. It's out there. You're going to see things about it. It's grosser and is it worse? It's more clear that this was the right thing to do. But it's another one. And I'm not sure. Maybe I felt there was more to say about it, but now I'm at the end of the sort of recap, and I'm like, I don't know where else to go with it. So maybe, I don't know what else I thought was interesting.
It's one of the really, I think, one of the clearer moments of this really should have happened. These are, as the Norton statement says, these are serious allegations. Mm-hmm. These are criminal allegations. Awful. The details of these are awful. I hope this is prompting a conversation inside Norton and inside other publishing houses about what you do if a person comes to you and reports that they were raped by an author that you are publishing. Because there is note, as you mentioned in this piece, that prompted by the growing Me Too movement, one of the rapes was alleged in 2015, and this 3 years later, about 3 years later, so late 2017, early 2018-ish, prompted by the growing Me Too movement, one of the victims wrote an email to Julia Reedhead, who's the president of Norton, accusing Blake Bailey of non-consensual sex. And she also emailed a New York Times reporter who responded. And that's, you know, probably where the New York Times started picking up this thread of investigation. Did Norton investigate at all? Did they respond to her at all? Do they have an internal policy or a system of what you do when this happens? Like, when Me Too was first starting, I don't think many, if any, publishers had mechanisms in place to investigate allegations like this and then make decisions about what to do. So, and they appear still not to.
Sounds pretty high in the sky to not have one at this point, to me.
But what's happening now is that the allegations have to come out in the New York Times before Norton says, like, it requires a New York Times level investigation before a publisher has at least publicly re-examined or removed the contract from that author. And I hope there are some conversations happening about that, about why victims of sexual assault may choose not to go to the police. And one of the women in this piece talks about deciding not to report it. There are very many reasons that victims do not report rape, but why they may reach out to other people in power as a heads up, as a, you might want to know this about this person, as a, this person did me wrong and you're in business with them, like whatever this victim's intention was. And frankly, it doesn't matter what she was trying to achieve in letting them know this. I think Norton has a responsibility. Any publisher would have a responsibility to investigate and hopefully to have made a decision sooner about this. We shouldn't be at this moment of this book deal where this decision is finally being made.
And I don't know, you know, what kind of, like you say, what they did when they got the email. Presumably they did something, and whatever they did, they decided it wasn't enough to not proceed. Which I guess it's plausible that that was a responsible move. It's hard to imagine a world in which it was. You know, maybe, you know, if people are being silent and you get one anonymous accusation, what do you do next? I don't think it's difficult, but I think it's required. And I don't have a good answer for what the right investigation thing, especially if these are distributed women over many years. I mean, there's a whole bunch of stuff here I don't
some
even get into.
In middle school.
Yeah, some of this stuff I really don't want to think about that much. I really don't want to think about it all, but in thinking about this, do you put out a call? Do you do a background check? Like, what is, I mean, this is a high profile book, a significant investment that happened over lots of time. You have some sort of like due diligence responsibility just to cover your own ass. Forget about the moral situation, which you shouldn't, but you don't even get to that point, because I'm sure Norton's going to take a bath on this now. Public relations wise, the other thing, like, this can't have been the right thing to do just from a operations point of view, it doesn't seem like.
Further down in this piece, there is a statement from a Norton spokeswoman who says, "We took this allegation very seriously. We were aware that the allegation was also sent to two people at Mr. Bailey's former employer and to a reporter at the New York Times, a news organization that was well equipped to look into it." I think that's telling. And then we did take steps, including asking Mr. Bailey about the allegations, which he categorically denied.
What's he gonna? Anyway.
And we were mindful of the sender's request for a guarantee of anonymity. Yeah. Like, what else was he going to do? And maybe this is all they're legally allowed to say. I'm sure that attorneys are all over anything that this spokesperson is allowed to release. But we did take steps, including asking him about the allegations. Like, when that is the only step that you're actually revealing here, what were the other
ones? What was the next thing you did? I mean, and I don't know, if it's an anonymized person, again, I'm sure there are people that are experts in this, to track all this. I can see how you could plausibly get yourself into a way, say, well, this is one person, we don't know their motives, blah, blah, blah. And Blake denies it. You have an endowment effect, right? You know, this is our book, mm-hmm. this is our title. But what is a best practice for this? Is there one? I don't know. I mean, if you all there know, like, from an HR point of view, from a company point of view, from a reporting point of view, like, how would a reporter go about doing this? You know, I guess they would contact, especially women they know that have worked with Blake Bailey over time. Have you ever heard anything? Is there any other, even if you don't have a specific story about yourself, have you heard, have you felt? Like, is there any other secondary indicator here? Or is one email from someone anonymous enough? I don't know. Another very difficult situation to be in.
Yeah. And it seems to me that there is some middle ground between, like, you have more options than just, we're going to continue the process of publishing this person's book, or we're going to cancel everything outright because of this allegation. Like, maybe we put things on pause and conduct a big investigation and figure it out. Maybe if we're relying on the New York Times being an organization that's well equipped to look into it, we don't do anything with Blake Bailey until the New York Times.
You're going to let the New York Times bust your dust, as Kathy Bates says in Primary Colors?
Yeah, I can't look away from that phrase in this statement, that she also sent it to a reporter at the New York Times, a news organization that was well equipped to look into it. That seems meaningful. A lot of people worked on this statement, and that's a thing they decided was important to say.
Yeah, and again, they haven't told us much. We don't know much. But it's troubling that there was so many people have come forward in a variety of different contexts about their experience with Blake Bailey. And this is where we are. There's still work to be done, and the structures, it doesn't sound like the structures are there yet, right? Clearly they're not. And just cause you have a structure doesn't mean it's going to work all the time. But it would be something else if Norton said, you know what, we did have a structure for looking into this. We did A, B, and C, which was our best understanding of how to deal with something like this. We do not, I mean, clearly one accusation is not enough for them to pull it, because they didn't. They could have, but they didn't do. So this is what we need to see to end a relationship with an author. And here's what we did, and we didn't see it. And you could say, and you know what, clearly we missed it. We messed this up. Mm-hmm. You know, and we're going to take a hard look at how we get at things about this in the future. We'd like to start an industry-wide discussion about how we can have some sort of clearinghouse, or is there any other way in which people can tell us hard, true things that they need to tell us, in a way that is, if not restorative, at least it doesn't make things worse, which this has. Oh boy. Well, I think that's it, Rebecca, for this week. I hope next week we get to bring you gladder tidings from the world of books and reading. But I think these discussions are in the direction of efforts we'd like to see succeeding largely. I don't know if we're in a two steps back and one step forward or vice versa situation here. Thank you as always for listening. You can find links, bookriot.com/listen. You can email us, podcast@bookriot.com. Get ready for Field of Dreams. Put it on hold. Do whatever you got to do here in a few weeks. And probably this is our last week of taking open calls for moms, dads, and grads. So get those into us before too long. Rebecca, thank you so much, and I'll talk to you next time.
Have a good one.